me call you all to order. Glad to see you all this morning. Could I call on Dr. Dennis George for our invocation, please?
Dear God in heaven, as these proceedings are about to begin, we want to pause to thank you for Western Kentucky University and for what it means in our lives and in the lives of all of our constituents. We thank you for our wonderful student body, for our outstanding faculty and staff, leadership, and particularly, God, this morning, we want to thank you for this group of individuals that comprise our Board of Regents. We thank you for the combined years of experience and wisdom that they bring to bear on these proceedings, their knowledge, their talents. And as these issues are discussed and deliberated today, oh God, we pray that you would imbue them with wisdom and judgment as these decisions are made, that they will be such to positively impact our institution as we move forward. In your name we pray. Amen.
Dennis, Regent Porter, could I call on you for the roll call, please?
Dr. Dennison?
Here.
Ms. Haskins?
Here.
Mr. Higdon?
Here.
Mr. Johnson?
Here.
Mr. Kennedy?
Present.
Mr. Meyer?
Here.
Dr. Mentor?
Here.
Mr. Smiley?
Here.
Mr. Wilkie?
Here.
Mr. Zilke?
Here.
Thank you, sir. At this time, let's entertain a motion to approve the minutes of the last board meeting, the quarterly board meeting of October 30, 2009.
Moved.
Okay, second. So second. Have a second. First, all those motion and a second. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All right. Moving along. Ms. Haskins, we're ready now for the Academic Affairs Committee, please.
Thank you. We'll have quite a few requests for a few action items. And action items, I don't know if we can do these together or do we need to do them one by one?
Can we do them all together?
We can do them all together unless someone has a request to separate one from the others.
I think we've read them over. Dr. Brooks, do you have any comments on any of them in particular?
I'm happy to comment on any one that you may want me to. I'll just quickly say, and I have individuals here who are prepared to speak to them if you wish. The Center for Applied Economics is, again, a response on the part of the college and the department to utilize their existing resources to be more responsive to needs of the region and beyond. Happy to discuss that if you want to. The undergraduate certificate in American Sign Language. American Sign Language is very much in demand. The truth is that we should be offering a lot more of it. It's a very expensive program. And so at this point, we are moving back to the certificate level. And it's an area that students can use in lieu of foreign language if they wish to. Certificate in computer literacy probably speaks for itself. And again, certificate programs, for those of you that may not be totally familiar with them, are an opportunity to take courses from respective areas targeted toward some intermediate level of preparation that is short of a minor or a major, and give people that opportunity. The occupational safety and health is a new initiative, as is work site health promotion. Those are two brand new certificates and new areas of initiative on the part of the College of Health and Human Services. The other two items, the honorary doctorate for Dr. Vicki Phillips, she's a very distinguished recipient, and we're not sure, I think, Dr. Ransdell, whether she's going to receive it in May or December yet, or are we now?
Communicated with her, and pending approval of this board, we'll follow back up with her to affirm board approval, and at that point we'll get her preference as to May or December.
Okay. And then the last one is the emeriti approvals. If there are questions on any of these, I'm delighted to provide additional information.
Did you say you did have someone here to speak to one of these items?
We can have someone to speak to any one of them for which there are questions. Yes.
I move approval of all items.
Second.
So all items have been approved and second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So they all are accepted. And then our informational items is a research report.
Dr. Richard Bowker is the Vice President for Research and also our graduate dean. And Dick, where are you? Oh, Dick is going to make this report.
Giving me the opportunity to bring you a report on research at WKU. And the nice thing about it is that the report is almost entirely good news. So at 9, 10 in the morning, it's nice to be able to present a report that's basically good news. But there's some challenges in there.
But it's not the 20th.
It's the 20th.
There's the bad news.
Other than having the wrong date.
If there's something that I think is hard for normal people to understand, it's really what we mean by research when we talk about research at a university. And by research, I mean the scholarly creative efforts of the faculty, the research efforts. Some of that research is applied. Some of that research is pure research. There's an intimate relation between those things. But I really want to talk about the entire research and creative activities of all of the faculty and staff and students. Why do we do this? Well, first, it defines the professoriate. It is what faculty do. The passion that faculty have for their scholarly endeavors, regardless of whether they're an artist who's working in ceramics or the zoologist that's studying the hawk that Gary just showed me out the back window, trying to chase his squirrel around, it is what defines faculty at a university. It's also a critical measure of institutional quality. I define the quality of an institution in two ways. What do our students do? What do they need here? What do they contribute to society? How successful are they in life? And secondly, what impact does the faculty have on the world? How well are the faculty known in the nation and in the world? Research, without a doubt, enriches the undergraduate and graduate experiences. Faculty are better teachers because they're engaged in the kind of work that they do, and it shows at both graduate and undergraduate levels. And the research, regardless of whether it's pure or applied, enriches our community aesthetically. It brings historical knowledge to the community, or it can bring practical ways of improving the everyday life of folks for the community, for our region, for the Commonwealth, and for our country. And it can also generate some significant revenue. For me, the targets and challenges are fourfold. First, to build capacity in the university to enable faculty and staff and students to engage in the process of scholarly creativity. Secondly, nurture the culture. We have to continue to have a culture that values these kinds of activities in the faculty. Identify opportunities. The Office of Sponsored Programs is out there beating the bush, trying to find where can we apply for grants to be able to facilitate the work of students and faculty. And then provide a reward system that makes it valuable, that values it for the students and faculty. And lastly, if we do these things, it's a wonderful way to enrich the institutional quality. One of the things we do is we're trying to provide stimulus funds for our faculty in order to be able to work. And we have four or three kinds of three kinds of awards that we give faculty. We have new faculty grants for $4,000. This year we awarded 20 of those. We have regular faculty scholarships for $3,000. 23 of those were awarded. And summer faculty $6,000 awards. We gave 25 of them. That amounts to about $300,000 worth of investment in trying to encourage faculty to move ahead in their scholarship and in their research. And it works. What it leads to is seed money for them to write a grant, or seed money for them to be able to start a project with their students. And we also can bring in some substantial funds. The figures, the series of figures I'm going to show you next are all basically the same. They have dollars on this axis and fiscal year here. Here we are, and we just finished the report for fiscal year 09. We're at about $23.7 million. We've brought in, we're up about 7% over last year. That's pretty good news in this economy.
Dick, go back to that.
Go back.
Not to him. if you look 06 to 07, the correlation there is federal appropriations and the earmarks in the federal budget is largely the reason for that decline from 06 to 07. That was about the time when in the political process earmarks began to come under great scrutiny. And were they were far and few between in that period of time. And these numbers do include research support from federal appropriations.
Yes, sir.
Robin, I don't know anything more to add to that, but that's
the only thing I would say is in 2007 they had none.
Right.
So they just continued to make no.
So I guess none kind of fits that far and few between category, maybe.
Well, the federal earmarks are an important component of this.
Yeah. I just wanted to point that out as to we were enjoying a pretty high level of close to $15 million for a period of in 3, 4, 5, 6 fiscal, 2003 through 2006, and we're at about 7 or 8 million now.
Yes, sir.
But we're gradually trying to rebuild our portfolio in federal support for our various research initiatives.
If you look at the number of awards, this is number of awards versus fiscal year, we're about the same as we were last year, declining a little bit in the number of awards received, but the dollar amount is going up, so that's good news.
That's good.
You're right. Number of proposals submitted.
Number of proposals.
Okay. I talked about this one.
Yeah.
There you go.
And here are the number of proposals submitted. The previous one was the number of proposals we received. This is the number of proposals submitted. For fiscal year, we submitted about 260 proposals last year. It is not a trivial amount of work to submit a proposal. It is a huge amount of work for faculty members to put together all of the information to be able to submit one of these proposals. It is hard work, and it can be, when the hit rate is 10% or 15%, it can be pretty discouraging to work that hard and then not get the grant. And of course, what we're trying to do is get faculty then to resubmit those proposals. We have some incentives in place for them to do that, financial incentives, because we just want, it takes two or three times sometimes to hit on one of these.
Dick, explain the bar for award numbers by fiscal year in 2007 is 2009 is 238, and the number of proposals submitted is 260. That is a profound percentage of success, and I expect some of those are multiple awards. So how do you? I know that there are long odds for a young faculty member to be successful, and there's a persistence value for a young faculty member. But this, looking at it at face value, would suggest an exceedingly high success rate for proposals submitted actually awarded. How do you reconcile those numbers?
And we do have a high success rate. But these numbers are the awards that are submitted last year, and those are the ones we're looking for this year to receive.
Right.
So the ones that we received last year had been submitted in previous years, so there's not a direct connection between the number of proposals we submit in a particular year and the number we receive.
Okay.
But still, our hit rate is good.
Yes.
We did well. If you look at how the awards are distributed, in terms of dollars, research has about almost $11 million, followed by public service kinds of awards and then various other kinds of categories. So the research ones, many of those are applied research. The public service awards are the kinds of awards that are enriching our teaching and learning and outreach in the community. So if you want to look at the applied mission of the university, it really falls in these categories there. If you look at how the dollars come to us, they come in different ways. Most of them are grants, federal grants, state grants, private grants. Some of them are memoranda of understanding, and then we have contracts and subcontracts as a way of receiving research. The money that we receive for facilities and administration, we have a 42.5% of the grant we received for facilities and administration. This year, it's down just a little bit. We're at $1.7 million that we receive, and this money reimburses the university for the heating and light and the library and the pencils and electricity that faculty, students, and staff use in order to execute these grants. If you look at the distribution of funds by the college, Ogden College by far with $12.75 million leads the way. We've had some remarkable growth in the College of Education and Behavioral Sciences and in the College of Health and Human Services. CEBS was up 21%, College of Health and Human Services up 37.5%, or 37%. These are great targets of opportunity, and really the faculty in all of those areas do great work. This past year, we had the ARRA, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Funds for that come in a couple of directions. Some of the funds come directly to the state and get meted out through the state government. Others come from the federal government. These are federal funds, and these are proposals that we've requested by college. So Ogden College has requested $8.6 million, Education Behavioral Sciences $1 million, other places about $5.5 million, and to date, Ogden has received about $1,125,300 in other areas. So we're doing okay, and we're hoping more of those come through. This year, The data that I presented so far have been last fiscal year. This fiscal year, to date, or at least I think to January 20th, no, January 15th, the awards are about the same. We're at $13.8 million last year. At the same time, we were $15.5 million. And if we look at the indirects, we're down a little bit to date, but these things don't flow in on a date-by-date basis. We really need to look at the end of the year. Considering the economy, I think we're going to be okay. If we look at the dollars requested, These are dollars requested each year. You can see we have an upward trend in the number of dollars we've requested. Well, this past year we requested $63 million. We received $23 million. That's pretty good. I'd like to see us double the amount that we request in the future. So in summary, the award dollars are increasing. We're at about $23 million. The awards received and submitted have declined slightly, but the numbers are up in terms of receipts. They do enrich, greatly enrich, the undergraduate and graduate experience, and enrich our community through public service and applied research grants, and they bring in about $1.7 million in indirect costs. So that's the take-home message. And I wanted to end on the great philosopher Pogo, who said, "Here we stand, confronted by insurmountable opportunities." And that really is the optimism that I see when I look at the research potential of the university. We have wonderful opportunities, and all we need to do is find some ways to facilitate and enable the faculty and the students and staff to move in these directions. It's not entirely a trivial task to do, but it is a huge, and it's not an insurmountable opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dick.
I have one question. What was the rationale for new faculty getting 4,000, regular 3,000, and summer 6,000?
Sure. Well, first we want to provide incentive for new faculty to get up and running in their, in whatever it might be. If it's a ceramicist, to be able to buy them clay and things like that. Regular faculty, these grants are used throughout the academic year, so they'll use that for a semester. And so $3,000 is pretty good for a semester, and they're happy to get that fund. So summer grants at $6,000 are essentially what they can earn if they teach a summer school class. Actually, it's a little more than they can earn if they teach a summer school class. And so we're trying to not stop them from teaching summer school, Don.
Oh, but, I see. But, in lieu
but,
of,
but like, we're trying yeah. to we're trying to enable them okay. to do their work in the summertime.
Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. And in fact, what they do with the summer stipend mirrors what you see in NEH, National Endowment for the Humanities grants, where summer stipends are a buyout for summer school
gotcha.
Time or
okay.
any other revenue-producing activities you have.
Okay.
And you sign an agreement with the federal government that you are not going to do anything other than that research right. and you will produce no other revenue.
And we have increased the amount of funds in this because we're really trying to help faculty move forward in this.
And you are. You are.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now we'll have some information about the Navitas contract.
I'm going to ask Dr. Kaler to come up and make this presentation. I would tell you, as most of you know, Dean's been Navitassing for about a year, and so I'm very pleased to make this today.
Well, good morning. To play off of Dr. Bowker's comment about opportunities, here is an opportunity that came to WKU about 9 months ago. And we've been working diligently with them, and we have traveled a lot of miles to make this agreement happened, and a little over two weeks ago, we actually had a contract signing ceremony in this room, and we had individuals from Perth, Australia, come here to visit our campus once again and to celebrate this celebration, this contract. So we're delighted to have this opportunity also. Navitas, I'm going to start off by explaining. Navitas started off in the 80s and 90s watching students come to countries and kind of struggle a little bit with their success. I'm sorry, I'm in your way, but I'm going to try and see this too. And what they were seeing was that the students were struggling when they came to other countries, to Australia at the time, not due to their academic ability necessarily, but because of other factors. Students were coming to a different education system. They were coming to a country that was perhaps different language from theirs, and just different cultural types of things. If you can imagine having your son or daughter arrive in Beijing, and not being welcomed at the airport by anyone, and they have to go navigate over to Tsinghua University, wherever that is in Beijing, and imagine the struggles that they would encounter, and then setting up their, finding linens, finding all the things that they have to do in order to be successful, that would be quite a challenge, I think it would be for me. And so this Navitus organization responded to that by trying to enhance that capability for those students to be successful. They developed a pathway college concept where these students actually are introduced into university studies in a enclosed environment with a cohort group and given a lot of TLC. I'll explain it a little bit more with some bridge programs here in just a moment. The concept has been applied now successfully at 23 other universities. And you can see the countries that are listed there. And a couple of weeks ago, we were the very first institution in the United States to actually start a pathways program with the Navitus organization. So we're delighted to have that opportunity. The University Pathway Program is actually two programs that will be here at WKU. The first one is providing a bridge for high school students, students who have completed secondary school in their country, to be able to come to WKU and to complete a set of courses in a very tight-knit cohort group, and upon completion of those courses and meeting certain criteria, maybe English proficiency, et cetera, that those students would then be able to continue on their sophomore year here at WKU as a, let me use the terminology, as a real WKU student. These will all be WKU students, but to kind of illustrate this. So they'll be going from Navitus for 1 year into our normal WKU population. The pre-master's program, similar kind of program, bridging program, where students would meet some certain criteria. They would be admitted based on criteria that they would have to meet, and then upon completion of those criteria in their bridge program, they would be able to continue on toward their master's program. This is a kind of a flow chart of what this would look like. You can see year 12 for secondary school, they start, or they finish, they come into the UPP as an undergraduate. They skip the freshman year at WKU as our traditional students would, our domestic students would, and they are in this protected environment in Navitus with extra services. Then they are
on our campus.
They're still on our campus, embedded in our campus, and at the end of that successful completion of that year, then they continue on as a sophomore and continue on through and progress hopefully to graduation. At the pre-master's program, you can see it's a similar kind of model. Characteristics of the Navitus model. I think this is the success of Navitus. They have been very successful, and they are embedded on a host campus, as Dr. Ransdale pointed out. They are here on our campus. They are in small classroom type settings. They use block teaching rather than maybe a 1 hour Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Their extended period of time in which those students are exposed to those faculty. They do a three semester per academic year. They're going to match our fall, spring, and summer semesters. They're 15-week semesters in the summer also. And their focus is on quality and embedding this student in the entire university setting. These students will look very much just like a WKU student that might be a traditionally admitted student here at WKU. Additional contact hours that they're going to be exposed to. They do a lot of follow-up studies. They call them tracer studies. And the students are guaranteed progression if they meet criteria to the sophomore level and so forth. They have a tremendously high success rate in their students transitioning from their pathway programs into the host university. They are all about quality. They keep stressing that from day one. That was the first word that was out of their mouth practically was, this is quality, and we want to assure all of our host universities that we are focusing on quality. Their curriculum is prescribed by our faculty here at WKU. It is moderated internally within Navitus, and it's also moderated by WKU officials. They do a tremendous amount of benchmarking and tracer studies, and the pathway programs actually have an advisory committee that's comprised half of WKU faculty and staff and half Navitas staff that come together multiple times each semester to talk about everything that's going on and to assure that the quality that we stand for at WKU isn't compromised in any way. Their success is based on never compromising the academic integrity of our institution or whatever their host institution. And they just continually impress me with the quality that they emphasize. Quality assurance continuing, those are some of the things that they talk about. I think one of the most striking things that they used as an illustration, which isn't really up here, but if let's say that a course coordinator from a particular academic department is looking at our course, at their courses, and at the end they provide work from that particular course. They'll provide a sample of the A's, a sample of the B work, a sample of the C work. They will hand that to the course coordinator in that respective academic department. If it doesn't meet their criteria, if they're sliding, let's say that really was B work that the Navitas program gave an A, they will adjust the grades. Okay, they are that focused on making sure that we do not compromise our academic criteria in any way. So they're pretty impressive with their quality measures. The outcomes of a strong quality assurance regime, I think there's two items there that stand out. One is the students progressed from their pathway program at 90% rate and go on into the host university, 90%. So that's freshmen going to the sophomore rate at 90%. Our own WKU students don't progress from the freshman to sophomore level at 90%. We don't even come close to that. And so that's a pretty impressive number. And then of those students who then progress onward, 95% of them graduate. That's an impressive number also, and one that we also at WKU, we don't match. So they really have stress quality, and I think that their academic performance, their academic focus, I think is very strong. This is the structure of the personnel that would be at WKU. They'll start off having some folks from Navitas come from Perth. Their first folks will show up here February 12th. I got an email this morning that their first person will come and start putting advertisements out and doing searches for staff. The first person that they'll be hiring will be their director, and that person hopefully will be on board mid-March, and they will be on this campus. These are at WKU campus staff. They will then hire their marketing and admissions director and marketing and admissions folks as quickly as possible so that they can get that recruitment and that marketing taking place. They actually are already doing that. I got a phone call last Friday from two students in Korea. We've heard about WKU. We've heard about the Navitas program. Can you tell us what that is? We're interested. And so they're already out there putting the word out, and we're already getting a lot of PR out around the world from Navitas. Their teaching learning director will come on in May, and then late summer, the student support team, so they can be trained and be ready to receive those students who arrive here in the fall, and academic folks will start with the beginning of the semester. Their finance manager and their IT system support manager, those folks will come on perhaps just a little bit later than what we have up here. These, by the way, are Navitas employees. They are not WKU employees. They will be paid by Navitas. Any benefits that Navitas provides, they are Navitas employees. They would not be in our human resources pool. Benefits to WKU, I think there's a tremendous number of benefits to WKU. First of all, we still have quality control over the academic materials, and we maintain our academic reputation. I think that we'll have a strengthened reputation in the international student population. WKU will be even more known in our international arenas because Navitas is going out there and talking about us at a level that we just can't do. We have one international recruiter that travels the world. You can imagine, he barely touches any population out there. Now we have Navitas network that's around the world, many, many, many different offices that are talking about WKU. We benefit from that, obviously. The increased number of international students, you'll see I've put a chart up in here with the number of international students that will be in the Navitas program that I'll share with you later. we think that the students that come out of this program will be better prepared, perhaps, than the students that would have just normally come straight to WKU on their own as an international student. We think that we've given that this will help them quite a bit. And we think that there's going to be some additional teaching opportunities for academics. If there is somebody who is a part-time faculty member with us and they want to pick up additional teaching opportunities, Navitas may be the opportunity for them to have some additional opportunities. Their staff is entirely, I'm sorry, the program is entirely supported by revenue that Navitas generates. There is no money coming out of WKU's budget to support Navitas. It is self-supporting, and I think that's a really important thing for everybody to be aware of. Additionally, there's fees and tuition that will be paid to WKU for the students who are in the Navitas program. They hire their faculty, we provide them space, they run their programs, they pay their faculty, they take care of all of that, but yet we will still benefit some fees from Navitas as a result of using our space and our being present on our campus. I think the revenue from the Navitas programs, I think, is pretty substantial, and I think it will be a real benefit to our campus outside of the Navitas program, because we'll be able to take that funding that we receive and be able to perhaps hire additional faculty and enhance our international programs that we serve that international population. So that money will go toward those students and toward that enrollment growth that we'll see on our campus. This is just some of the course advising and personal advising that Navitas would be providing. They bring with them unique challenges that that they do address, and I think some of them, visa extensions, social adjustment, some of those things that those students may need some additional help with, they're going to provide that help to them. So just kind of a little bit of an example of that. Here are some of our academic support programs that we're going to see in Navitas. This is very similar to some of the things that we're doing with students in Academic Advising and Retention Center and Learning Centers across the campus. But I think that this is going to be specifically for Navitas students, but they'll also be able to use all of our resources and services, so they'll have an enhanced opportunity to have a lot of help going their way. Number of students that are coming our way this fall, we're looking at, and these are the projected numbers from Navitas. I will say that I think that these are pretty conservative. I think that these numbers, we will hit these marks, I think, pretty easily. Right now, we're looking at hopefully bringing in about 88 students for this fall. Next year, 2011, 200, and then so on. You can see, if 95% of these students graduate from the Navitas program after 1 year, and then we retain them at a 90% at a rate that we keep them in our population, and then they graduate at 90%, you can see how dramatically our international population on this campus is going to grow. It will grow very, very quickly. And so that's an exciting thing for our campus, for the international reach part of our vision statement. Where will Navitas be located? They'll be located in Tate Page Hall. They're going to start with two cohort groups, 88 students. They'll probably have one track that's designated toward the science track. So students who are interested in science-type majors, they would be in that track. The other track will be liberal arts, more of a general education track. So students have the opportunity to go to a wide range of majors when they continue on their sophomore year. First arrival of staff in mid-February. That is a very, very, very quick explanation of the Navitas program. I'm happy to answer any questions that you guys might have.
The first year they're here, they'll primarily be housed or work out of Tate Page Hall. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then after that, they'll flow into the populace of the, exactly. Of the student body.
Exactly. Now, but they will be integrated as much as we possibly can into our campus. So you use the word housed. The academic part of it will be in Tate Page Hall. But for every other item, for anything else, they will live in our residence halls. We don't want them kind of all glommed together right. In one residence hall. We want the heat.
Spread them out.
Yeah, so we're going to integrate them fully throughout our campus.
But most if not all, will be in our residence halls.
Exactly. We want their students in our residence hall. Dr. Birch and I visited three of their campuses in the fall. And I think that's a unique opportunity that we can provide to Navitas, is that we have a residential setting, whereas the campuses that we saw, they were relying upon host families or letting the students have apartments that they could live in and so forth. that's a benefit that I think that we can offer to them is our residential setting and all the programming that goes on.
They'll get the true college life a little bit.
Yeah, and they've already met with Kit Tolbert and Brian Kuster. They've already started meeting with several departments on the campus. So these students will be very integrated into our campus. They really should just blend right in with the rest of our students as best as we can do.
I had the pleasure to get to meet with those guys at that luncheon at we were there, and they're very well read. They got a very, very good program.
It is a sharp, sharp program, and I from day one when they came to visit us, I was impressed with their focus on quality. One thing that I can add is that that quality has led to all of those campuses, 23 other campuses that they have already. For those that have completed their first 10-year contract, they have a 100% renewal rate. With their other campuses. I think that speaks volumes to the fact that those campuses are really, really pleased with what Navitas is doing on their campus. So that's a real positive indicator.
Let me put this in a little bit of a business context for us, and all the things Dean described, particularly the quality measure, the achievement of internationalization goals, all are very important to us strategically. But from a business standpoint, understand these will be full-paying out-of-state students. Juxtaposition that opposite, many of our domestic students come on scholarship, either through alumni legacy programs for a tuition incentive program rate, which is half the out-of-state rate, or they come on scholarships for forensics or athletics or whatever. Most, and I won't, but I think I'm comfortable in saying most of our domestic out-of-state students are not full-paying students. These will be, and that's a big difference. There's a financial value to us going forward, and we all know enough about our financial circumstance as a public institution to know that we've got to be addressing financial strategies that are alternative strategies to what has been the norm in creating our financial underpinning as an institution. This is an important part of that strategy. Point number two I want to make to you is how Navitas is a for-profit company. They will share in the revenue in that first year. 30%?
Mm-hmm. It varies on the program.
Okay.
We get 30.
Yeah, they will share, right. They will share in that revenue the first year. That's what's in it for them. I mean, they've got offices all over the world. They've got overhead. They've got expenses to cover. And they've created this business model, and they're a New York Stock Exchange traded company. But we win through their success, and from the sophomore year on, they're full paying for us. So it's a great concept, and I'm really pleased that we're the first U.S. university to sign an agreement with them, because I expect there will be more going forward. Once this becomes more known.
You might be interested that that they did sign with University of Massachusetts.
Yeah, right, week they were here, they were, the University of UMass was the second. At any rate, I wanted you to understand the financial dynamics. Now, point number three. We've got some challenges, and in the plan that we'll talk about at the end of this meeting today, we've got some real space challenges to address going forward. And whether or not we renovate Tate Page Hall, which I'm dubious about investing too much money in what is a flawed building for many reasons, we've got to find a home for our Honors College. We've got to find a home for the Chinese flagship program. If we're successful with the Confucius Institute, that will require a space commitment. We've got to find a proper and suitable space for this program that may or may not be long-term in Tate Page Hall. It will short-term. It is our initial and early, very preliminary thinking that after a year or two, we're likely to dedicate some of the revenue through the value-addedness of the out-of-state margin, which is 2.5 times the in-state rate, from some of these students to addressing those space needs in a related synergistic way that relates to international programs, to Honors College, and to other related variables. Purely conceptual at this point, but this gives us a dimension and an opportunity to address base funding capacity and address correlated space needs going forward, either in Tate Page Hall or a new building that would be a replacement building for Tate Page Hall. So again, that's not been fleshed out. That's a long way to go to get definition. But I wanted you to get this underpinning of Navitas in this meeting, because it won't be but another meeting or two that we'll be coming back to you as to how we optimize the business portion of this opportunity.
So in this theoretical model, you just, you know, think piece that you just described,
right,
the revenue that comes from these full paying students would be plowed into buildings instead of back into the academic mission.
Keep in mind the numbers here.
Yeah.
The 200 students would generate $2 million in annual revenue.
Right. Actually,
300, 400, 500, 600 students, you begin to see the financial impact. So I said, I'm confident a portion of this revenue will be used to address related needs. Most of it will go into the base budget.
I think one of the things, a point of clarification, presidents ask us to work through that model. And the first questions that we've asked is, the first question we ask is, what is it going to take to support those Navitas students? If in good conscience we're bringing those international students here, we are obligated to support those students.
Need resources.
That's faculty, that's staff, it's space, it's other things. And the very first thing that we put up there is over the first 5 years, anticipating how many additional faculty. And I think the first run of the numbers, and it may not be the final, was 41 additional faculty would be required. If these numbers play out, and there's no reason to think they won't, you would need 41 additional faculty over the first 5 years. Now, you'll need staff, you're going to need counselors, you're going to need additional people to work in the international office because we've got a lot more visas to process. You're going to need a lot of people, some in academic support, some outside of academic support. And so we're charting that and showing how many dollars. You can readily see, first couple of years, it's just getting going. But you can readily see by about the third year, you are at a point that you've got discretionary revenue. And I will just add as an aside, when Dean and I visited, I think every campus that we were on, this is just kind of coincidental, but every campus we were on had built a building. In one instance, I don't want to look at Dr. Tell when I say this, but in one instance, they had so many business students come through Navitas that they actually built a whole new business building to accommodate, and had to curtail Navitas students enrolling because it didn't retain the balance of domestic and international. So the other thing, the students they are bringing, the retention rate is remarkable, but it's predictable. They are not bringing students that are not able to be successful. They are using a model that said, though, these students are studying in a different country in a different language, and they can afford to be here. They can pay. But what they are doing is making sure they are successful in that first year. But I think it's going to be pretty astonishing as you look down the years of the model and see the dollars that are produced. And the other thing, it's a very entrepreneurial initiative, but the best thing it does is it's also saving us money. Wherever Ann is, we can put this on cost savings. Right now, as we've made efforts to increase our international population because we think that mix is important for our campus, it's pretty expensive to recruit international students. We've ventured for the last several years into using agents on occasion. It's incredibly expensive if you try to have a full staff and you try to be everywhere you need to be. And we've never even presumed we could do that. But we have experimented with agentry. That's a slow process. It's unpredictable. It's risky. Increasingly, you also discover you need more scholarship incentives. So all of a sudden, what the Navitas model gives us is the opportunity to do something that was priority that we wanted to do anyway, and to do it in a way that does not take $1 or one resource from base budget or institution, and almost unbelievably produces additional revenue that will enable us to enhance the quality of experience on this campus for not just those international students, but for all of our students. it is a really remarkable model, and we saw in the campuses we visited, and many more we talked to, evidence on every campus, and in ways that is used to enhance. So it's really a very positive model. The only reason it wouldn't work for you is if you didn't really welcome international students to your campus, and you just have to be in some other planet right now not to recognize the value to our own students of that mix. So it's taking us a little time, but I do want to assure you that faculty positions are high on there, as are staff, as are positions in other areas of the campus.
And international programs.
Yeah, that'll be needed to reinforce this.
But we will have to address the space issue as part of that whole business plan.
Space issue is a significant part of it, yeah.
As the number of Navitas programs increase in American universities, how will that affect our numbers as to how many we get? And
well, they're committed to making this model work at WKU. They're investing quite a large amount of money in making this successful. Every single one of their campuses that they put in, they invest quite a bit of money, and they don't want to lose that profitability for them on this campus. So they would not saturate this market to a point where it would be a demise to their financial model.
Ms. Haskins, their investment is an upfront one. It's a huge investment up front. They are big losers if this did not work. And when you look where they've placed other programs, you'll see that they disperse them pretty broadly. And they would, as Dean said, it would not be profitable for them, because they are better off for us to grow and be very successful than to look for others in the region. At one point, Dean, in listening to their business conversations, they were talking about 30-some-odd, ultimately, over a next decade in the U.S. So they're just now
not
entering.
Not 30 in the U.S.
No.
30 total in their worldwide.
Yeah, as they're entering the U.S. market, yeah.
Well, why are we not voting on that contract? I mean, usually we vote on a lot of things here.
I'm worried about that.
The board authorizes me to engage contracts.
Could we get a copy of the contract? I mean, I like what I hear, but I'd like to see a copy of the contract.
Sure. No, I mean, gosh, Larry, we do hundreds of contracts almost every week of various types. I've kept the board informed as this one has unfolded. But sure, we can circulate that contract to you.
Any other questions?
I had just one.
Sure.
The students who are coming in pay money to Navitas that first year. Do they pay any more any other time they're here, or before they come here, or is that where Navitas makes their profit?
Navitas will request from the students an upfront payment for the first semester, and that will include all of the tuition and all the costs that student will incur while they're here the first semester. After that, then they pay the tuition or all the additional fees to Navitas each semester. Navitas will then provide to us what is our due out of what they collect.
But that's all your question. They pay a flat amount agreed upon in advance to Navitas for the first year of the program. After the first year, they are in our system.
Okay.
Our faculty, we hire the faculty, we collect the tuition. They are out of the picture dollar-wise.
Okay.
Navitas will still be very interested in those students and will be tracking them, because they want to make sure that they're successful for the following 3 years, or graduate program, you know, for the following 2 years. So, the first year, they're a Navitas financial responsibility.
Their corporate reputation and their business plan is dependent on those students being successful here after they leave the Navitas portfolio after their freshman year.
Any other questions? Well, I'll keep you posted on this. Thank you so much for letting me have a little time to show Navitas to you.
Good work. Thanks, Dean.
Thank you, Dean.
And we'll have our enrollment report.
As long as Dean is here, he'll make that too.
Okay, well, in your packet, I was asked to provide to you in advance some numbers. So in your packet, you have two documents. One looks like this, and then one looks like this. In looking at the overall enrollment report, that was 2 weeks prior to the start of the term. I'm going to give you an update on that. Right now, that is saying that the total enrollment was up 9.2% or 1,510 students. As of the first day of class, we are up 1,236 students. That number is very volatile for the first week or so. And so I typically like to give you that report today to give you the most contemporary information that I can give you. So as of today, our total, as of the first day of the semester, our total enrollment for spring 10 is 19,079 students. That's up 6.9%. Just going down a couple of the items there, African-American enrollment is up 319 students or 18.6%. Undergraduate enrollment is up 6.4%. Graduate enrollment is up 10.1%. Full-time and part-time percentages are both up about the same, 6 and 9%. If you go over on the other side, where the first-time students, that report there said 73, but we are now up to 325 students, and we're up 48 students over last year for a 17.3% increase in new first-time freshmen. First-time graduate students are also up 216 students, or up 26, or a 13.7% increase. And so you can see that numbers are looking very, very, very healthy again for spring semester. I would say that probably we're going to be we're on track to be very close to being about the same percent increase that we were up in fall. We'll be up that similar time for spring semester. So I was also asked to provide a snapshot of the regional campus enrollment, and the report that you have here is a report that indicates the number of course enrollments for all the regional campuses and for distance learning classes, that's web-based classes, telecourses, correspondence courses. And so you can see that a final 2009 spring enrollment was 9,914 course enrollments, and this spring you're at 10,448 course enrollments.
I don't think we have that.
It's this document right here. Yeah, you did get an update of the first day of class enrollment. So I'm sorry to give you a couple of different numbers there, but I'll try to clean that up for next time so that we can give you, you know, one report that we can all reference. But I try to give you the most. It changes every 5 minutes. The number of enrolled students changes. That's why at some point in the semester we do an official snap of the enrollment, and that's the number that we stick with and we report consistently. Right now things are very volatile and it changes constantly as our advisors are registering students and students are registering online and so forth. So I try to get you the most contemporary data right now. So any questions about enrollment?
Very encouraging.
I do want to make one comment. It's an incredibly good enrollment report, and I know the dean and his staff have worked very hard, but I want to say something else. The president's noted before, some of it is numbers up that are brand new students, but a lot of it is retention efforts, and that's coming from faculty, it's coming from department heads and staff and deans. People are doing extraordinary things. It's not unusual to find people at the end of the semester with telephone brigades, so to speak, and calling and finding out what's happened to students that have not re-enrolled. Lots of support systems, and I just think it's very few people realize how many people on this campus, particularly faculty, are doing extraordinary things to make this happen. So,
on the retention item, you reminded me, Dr. Birch, we are now fully engaged in a different kind of retention strategy with our students also. We are dismissing students, okay? And that's not retention, but it really isn't kind of in a way. We have a lot of students historically that we have retained that probably is not a very responsible thing for those students to continue on our campus. They're disruptive in our classrooms, perhaps. They're slowing the academic progress of other students down. And so we have started to very aggressively dismiss students who it's not appropriate for them to be on this campus. That benefits this campus. It benefits our students. It helps our faculty because we raise the quality of this entire institution by dismissing students We put them on probation when they fall below a certain criteria, and if they don't meet that criteria after being on probation, then we do dismiss, or we say that they're dismissed. We do give them the opportunity to appeal, and that's what the Academic Advising Retention Center is up to their necks in just recently. So we are being much more aggressive about dismissing students. And so if you do hear from a student that they have been dismissed, yes, they probably have, and it probably is not, I probably can most assuredly say, it is not because of one semester, it is probably not because of two semesters. How it works is the first semester that they fall below 2.0, they're put on probation. So the next semester, they're on probation. If they do not hold a GPA that second semester, then they are subject to dismissal. They can appeal, and if they have a good excuse, a good reason, that they may be warranted to come back, we may give them another chance. So quite possibly a student could be here three semesters before they truly, truly are dismissed from this campus. But and as of this fall, we, for the first time, have been dismissing them for an entire year. What we have seen is that a student is dismissed. If they're dismissed for a semester, they may move off our campus. We do get them out of the residence halls, but they're still hanging around. A semester is not very long to tread water, so they go hang out somewhere, and next semester they're back on our campus. Now it is a year, a full calendar year that they're dismissed. I think with our enrollment numbers, we can afford to be more progressive in this. This raises the bar for everybody, and I think this is the right way to go in enrollment management. And so Dr. Ransdell has given us the ability to do this, and I think this is the right direction for our school. So just to add that part to our enrollment numbers, that we're not continuing to just take the bottom, but we're growing up on top, and I think that's a real positive thing for this campus.
And this is a strong collaboration with student affairs and academic affairs in doing the right thing for all parties, and our student affairs staff is very much a part of this more progressive position on the university's part.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to turn, Barbara.
Last item, I'm going to ask Dean Svoboda if he would briefly update you on our winter term. This is, I believe, Don, our fifth winter term, and we still get really good responses.
Thank you. You have in your packet this little back and front and back flyer. It is our fifth winter term. This is, I've been here before. This is yet another enterprise of DLO. We just completed our winter term on Friday last. You will see in the chart our growth, overall growth from in the last 5 years, from the first year we started in 2006 till winter of 2010, 34.4%. The growth in graduate students this last year has been very, very, very positive, a growth of 44%. We can generally attribute that to the work of Dr. Bacher and the deans and department heads and faculty, as we've tried to encourage more classes to be offered, giving those students more opportunities. The number was 2129 is our official count number for winter term. Even though the six-year trend has been significantly increased, this year we were down by about 100 students, which is about 5%. And we believe there are two reasons for that. We believe that one is the economy. And a lot of things get thrown into the thing about the economy, and so we're going to do some research on that to find out where we're at. Probably the winter and summer terms are the two most researched pieces, groups of students I've ever seen in my life. We do surveys to everybody. We do focus groups with everybody. But we're working with IT to identify. We're going to look at the students that were dropped for non-payment at the very end and actually identify them individually, go identify a group of them and do a focused interview to try and find out specifically, why did you drop? Was it in fact that? But our second reason, and we're going to research this as well, second reason we believe we had fewer numbers, and not significantly enough fewer, but fewer numbers, is because of the 120-hour requirement that was passed by this board. We believe But there's a large number of students, and frankly, if I put myself in that role, I'd do the same thing. Get ready to sign up for winter term, and our largest group of students for winter term is seniors. And that's primarily to make sure they graduate, to get that last course to graduate. Well, by golly, if I've already got 25 courses, and I now, as of the first year, only need 120, and I've got 125, why in the world would I sign up? I mean, you know, you're 18 years old. You're not maybe looking to make an in-depth contribution to your intellect for one more course. So we think those are the two primary reasons. We had a significant number. Oh, I would just say that there are 241 sections, 191 courses. All colleges participated. Study abroad was 29% increase. This is a very, they just kind of skyrocketed this year. Students were in all over, including 28 students from the Gatton Academy. 57% of our winter term courses were online courses. And I think you can see the rest. If there's any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. Yes?
Has there been any thought given to, because I know I've heard some students talk about this, as far as McLean Hall and Bates Runner Hall, which are upper division halls, and like you said, it's mostly upper division students who are taking winter term classes. Has there been any thoughts about maybe trying to keep those dorms open so those students could live on campus and take those classes?
We've thought on that for 5 years, or 7 years. Howard, do you want to talk about that?
I'll respond to that. We are studying those numbers right now. The numbers have increased, the last two winter terms, we found that the number of students that would move back in for January was below the number that we would require to staff the building. So we've got to have a balance there. We have, looking at these numbers that just finished up last week, it may be more positive, and if so, we'll respond accordingly.
All I can say in addition to that is we've gotten more dorms open and available now than we ever had, and we have more meals available now than we ever had.
Yeah.
That's got to make sense financially, and that's why student affairs, residence life, and Don's office has to work together on that. You can't keep a residence hall open for 30% of its occupants for a three-week period in the middle of the winter.
Sure. I would anticipate Navitas will help that equation because those are going to be year-round students.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Burt. Yeah. And thank all of you who provide us with information. And that brings to close the Academic Affairs Committee meeting.
Thank you, Yvette.